That's the legendary Cuban percussionist Chano Pozo and the legendary trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie with one of the most famous jazz standards, Manteca, which helped usher in the era and genre of Afro-Cuban jazz in the United States. Chano Pozo, Gillespie, and arranger Gil Fuller all collaborated on the orchestration and arrangement of this history-making tune all the way back in 1947. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, December the 18th. And President Obama's announcement yesterday that the United States and Cuba have agreed to pursue bilateral talks immediately to cease hostilities after 53 years sent stocks soaring, peace and political activists applauding, and diehard opponents of the communist regime to backroom drawing boards to plot their next moves. Seeking to reverse the Cold War Kennedy-era isolation policy toward Cuba, Obama is making a bold move, arguing that isolation of the Caribbean island simply has not worked. But in the twilight of his tenure, and now with opposition even within his own battered party, can Obama pull it off? Diplomatic scholar, historian, attorney, and prolific author Dr. Gerald Horn joins us today to put Obama's stunning announcement in political and historic perspective. Dr. Horn is the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He has written more than 30 books and more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. His recent books include Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, and the very famous book that was mentioned just yesterday, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. Gerald, it's great to have you once again with us. We look to you to decode things in a way that nobody else does. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, few saw Obama's move coming, although that handshake with Raul Castro at Nelson Mandela's funeral might have been a hint almost exactly a year ago. But as stunning as the announcement was, it does suggest that the president took even his own party by surprise. Considering the historicity of this event and the fallout it was likely to generate, did Obama handle this the right way, seeming to be doing this on his own? What do you make of it?
Well, it's very difficult to reverse decades of a failed policy that had as President Obama himself said, he felt, and the record showed, that this policy of isolation was not accomplishing the major purpose, not necessarily to bring democracy, that's fairy tales for children, but to overthrow the Communist Party rule and destroy the public sector and destroy socialism. Obviously, that had not worked. And so now they're going to embark on another policy, which is engagement. But the critics in both parties need to recognize that Mr. Obama's hand has been forced because there is a larger picture that the mainstream press is ignoring. That larger picture ignores what we've talked about on this program before, which is that according to certain analyses, the Chinese economy is now larger than the U.S. economy. And according to the late Robert Fogel, Nobel laureate in economics from the University of Chicago before he died recently, this trend is determined and bound to continue, perhaps having the Chinese economy, according to Fogel, 10 times larger than the U.S. economy within decades. And China not only has a major foothold in the Bahamas, right off the southern coast of Florida, Chinese interests have been pouring a tidal wave of capital into the Bahamas. You may recall that in June 2013, right before coming to Sunnylands, California to meet with President Obama. Chinese President Xi Jinping met in Trinidad and Tobago with the Trinidadian leadership and the CARICOM leadership, meaning Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, et cetera. Chinese capital has been gushing into the CARICOM nations as well. And Chinese capital has been gushing into Cuba. In fact, not only Chinese capital, but there's been all these high-level meetings of military leaders between Cuba and China of late. And so Mr. Obama and his circle of advisors had to consider whether or not national security interests of the United States dictated that the U.S. should have a more muscular presence on the island, which would mean a more normalized official presence on the island, in order to help to safeguard U.S. national security. And recall that it was just in October 1962 that the U.S. president, John Kennedy, was considering a similar question when there were these allegations about Soviet missiles being placed in Cuba to safeguard Cuba, and the world came to the brink of nuclear destruction. Keep in mind as well that Russia has resuscitated and revived its relationship with Cuba as well. I mean, President Putin has been a frequent visitor to Havana. As you know, there's been a turnabout in Russian relations with the United States, one of the major stories of 2014 in light of the events in the Crimea and Ukraine. And as a result, the United States has slapped sanctions on Moscow and is poised to slap even tighter sanctions on Moscow sometime in the next few days. Keep in mind as well that Moscow's relations with Cuba remain robust. It's interesting as well that the United States has slapped sanctions on Venezuela, another close ally of Cuba. And what's remarkable that most of the mainstream commentators have ignored is that despite the fact that we were told for decades that anti-communism was one of the sacred principles of the United States, violation of which could lead to your being jailed or marginalized, perhaps even subject to assassination, which was happened in the case of the late Paul Robeson. And yet, here in the United States is normalizing relations with communist Cuba, has normalized relations with China, including a trade relationship, has normalized relations with Vietnam, and yet is worsening relations with non-communist Moscow after they threw out the communists, and has terrible relations with non-communist Caracas. Go figure.
Well, you know, there's never a thing called logic when you talk about foreign policy, and even domestic policy. I want to ask about what this means in terms of this gravitational pull. If the United States is reaching out to Cuba and Cuba is reaching back, what is there going to be a change, a particular shift between Russia and Cuba? Is it going to change by that arrangement if it should come to be?
It's possible, but also to a certain.
Are we cracking up there? We losing you a little bit there, Gerald?
How's this? Is this better?
You know what? Yes, let's go with it because you've been kind of in and out a bit. But go ahead.
And, of course, I can give you another number if you want to take a music break and call me back.
All right. Good plan. I like that plan. So we'll take this little music break and we'll call you back at this other number.
Okay.
What is important? All right, so we're back with Dr. Gerald Horn. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Well, a couple of things. I doubt if relations between Havana and Moscow will change appreciably. Cuba, in some ways, is in the position of India. India is sort of like the belle of the ball right now. It's being courted by the United States. Obama changed the State of the Union address in January in order to go to India. Putin was just in New Delhi signing a raft of deals. The Chinese leadership was just in New Delhi. The relationship between India and Japan stretches back 2,500 years to the founding of Buddhism, and Japan wants to get closer to India in order to counter China. And now Cuba is in an analogous position. It's being courted by Russia. It's being courted by China. Now it's being courted by the United States. And I don't see any advantage to Cuba worsening relations with Russia. In fact, another factor you need to consider when considering this normalization between Havana and Washington is not only Russia and China, but Brazil. That is to say that the White House quite honestly and truthfully admitted that their terrible relations with Havana was compromising its relationship with hemispheric neighbors. This is quite important, not only in the run-up to the meeting in Panama that takes place in a few months between the nations and republics of the Americas, but also because in order to confront a unified Europe and a China that is consolidating strength in Asia, and by the way, just a few days ago, a remarkable development happened when a train rumbled from China to Madrid, Spain, which portends the rise of what China calls a Silk Road, which is a network of trains and roads and airports and internet cables that will tend to unite the most populous continent, Asia, with the richest continent that is Europe, a clear and continuing threat to U.S. hegemony, which is bound to be reduced in coming years in any case. But keep in mind that the United States wants to consolidate its role in the Americas to better confront a consolidated Europe and a consolidated Asia with Chinese leadership, but it finds it difficult to do when the states of the Americas are looking askance at Washington because of its sour relationship with Havana, and at a time when Brazil, which has hemispheric dreams all of its own, has been pouring capital into Cuba, which has been taking foreign policy positions at odds with those in the United States and winning plaudits from the neighbors in the Americas, for example, objecting to the U.S.-sponsored coup government in Honduras, to cite one example amongst many. The nations of the Americas have moved to the left, not only in Brazil, but in Bolivia, but in Ecuador as well, but in Venezuela. And so in order to adjust to this new reality, the Obama administration had to adjust U.S. policy. See, the problem, however, is that Washington and the U.S. elite in general is not accustomed to understanding that the United States might be on the back foot. The United States, is, in many ways, reminds me of many black Americans and vice versa. You know, black Americans, even when they're retreating furiously, always have to act like they're advancing. That's how we roll. We can't admit that we're retreating.
Let me go, hold me. Okay.
Exactly. And U.S. is the same. They can't admit that they may be on the back foot. That's why you have all this blather and bloviating on the cable networks that hasn't raised a scintilla of evidence akin to what I've just brought to your attention, which will be intuitively obvious to anyone who follows current events.
Well, let's kind of draw a bit on your book. You talked about the race to revolution, the U.S. and Cuba during slavery and Jim Crow. There is a very interesting history there, I think, that is pertinent, that is directly related to this African-American president. Do you find any such link here with the book and what you're claiming in the book, that there was a long-standing relationship between African-Americans and Cuba? Has Obama, in fact, pivoted toward his ethnicity?
Well, you know, that's a complicated question. I mean, it is fair to say that a base of support for Obama has been the black community, even though the black community has suffered grievously during his years in office, although admittedly not necessarily because of his actions and inactions, but that's just the fact. And with that base of support, it's easier to take this kind of dramatic move because, to be fair, the black leadership has been moving in that direction for some time. Now, even though, because of campaign contributions, a significant percentage
of the Congressional Black Caucus has been voting in favor of the blockade against Cuba. If you look historically, you'll find that over the decades, black leaders like Reverend Jesse Jackson, Minister Farrakhan, former mayor of Oakland, and then and Congressman Ron Dellums, and many black journalists, National Association of Black Journalists, oftentimes trooped to Havana and called for the kinds of moves that Mr. Obama is now executing. At the same time, however, we shouldn't be too misty-eyed and romantic about this question, because, as noted, part of the strategy of President Obama is basically to erode socialism in Cuba. And part of that strategy involves increasing remittances from Cuban Americans to the island. That is to say, already Cuban Americans sent about $2 billion to the island, to their relatives, and with the change in policy, that'll quadruple. That's a tidal wave of capital flooding into the island, and we know that when those remittances first began, it exacerbated race and class tensions on the island, because those we would describe as Cubans of European descent, for historical reasons having to do with white supremacy, oftentimes have more wealth. And so therefore they can send their relatives on the island more wealth, which increases the yawning gap between what we would call black and white on the island, which exacerbates class and race tensions, which is something that the party, Communist Party, and the Havana leaders and authorities are going to have to deal with. And it's something that I'm sure was contemplated by President Obama when he allowed this to happen. Likewise, since you mentioned the book, I should note that, as I say in Race to Revolution, before 1959, Cuba was a tourist playground for the United States. After 1959, you saw Montego Bay and in Jamaica and Barbados and Trinidad, for example, begin to supplant Cuba as a tourist haven. But now, with the prospect of more tourists coming to Cuba, and after all, Cuba's population of about 12 million is about four times the size of Jamaica's population of 3 million, and Jamaica, of course, is the largest, has the largest population in the English-speaking Caribbean, there is a prospect of tourism in some of the CARICOM nations taking a hit, which could exacerbate tensions in those places, too. I'm not sure if that was contemplated by the White House, but you should also know that as Mr. Obama was making his remarks yesterday, that the stock of Carnival Cruise, which sails into all of these islands, was ticking upwards. In fact, as you know, there's a hot play on Wall Street as we speak about these Cuba-related stocks.
Right. And one went up 142%, the Cuba drink company.
Right. And then, of course, with telecommunications, auto companies, et cetera, they all stand to profit. Agribusiness stands to profit as well, which brings me to another point, which Mr. Obama is going to have to deal with, which may work to his favor, which is that just like class and race tensions may be exacerbated on the island of Cuba by this normalization, the same thing could happen in the United States. I mean, it's interesting to look at the Wall Street Journal editorial today. As you know, that's the last refuge of the Neanderthal right. But they are not as hostile to this normalization as you might have suspected. And I think it's because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce embraced this normalization. Agribusiness in the citadel of the white right, that is Alabama, embraced this normalization. And so when Congress reconvenes in January with the largest Republican majority in decades, you are bound to see tension and conflict within the Republican Party with regard to this normalizing. And so all the chest beating by Senator Marco Rubio of Florida and Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens, because I don't think that you're going to see necessarily a united white right with regard to this policy.
Well, you know, that also begs the question of What does this say about the ideological leanings of the Castro regime? Have they begun to kind of soften their position, their ideological position? Are they more embracing now of capitalism, but with certain limits? What do you make of the ideological shift, if any?
Well, as you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, Cuba went through what was called a special period, and there's no question that the island was suffering and has been suffering as a result of the collapse of what had been its major patron. To a certain degree, Caracas, Venezuela, has filled the vacuum, but not necessarily sufficiently. And as a result, as you know, there has been an increase of entrepreneurs in Cuba. In fact, part of the new normalization policy that Mr. Obama has crafted is to try to bolster that entrepreneurial class in Cuba as sort of a counterweight to the Communist Party. And that, of course, is designed to exacerbate tensions in Havana and on the island, and perhaps it will, probably it will. There's a question as to whether or not the Cuban authorities will be able to manage that tension. But stepping back and taking an even longer view, as I've told you before, I have this book coming out in a few months on the Haitian Revolution, and it's very curious and very interesting, it seems to me, for students and politicos alike to look at the Haitian Revolution in comparison with the Cuban Revolution. That is to say, 50 years after 1791, when the Haitian Revolution commenced, you had the effective split of the island of Hispaniola and the origins of the Dominican Republic, which had been engineered not least by the machinations of Washington, by the United States. You had an explosion of violence between and amongst people of different ancestries, different colors, etc. And that has led to a tension between Haiti and the Dominican Republic that has existed to this very day and is still manifesting, probably reached a new low in the 1930s when Dominican dictator Trujillo massacred thousands of Haitians on the border. Just at the same time, you may recall, when he was accepting European migrants from Europe who had been ousted because of the rise of fascism and were being shut out even of the United States. But here we have 50 years after the Cuban Revolution, and you see a retreat of Washington. There's no other way to explain it. The past policy of overthrowing the regime through trying to assassinate the leadership, blowing up airplanes, setting off bombs in cafes, trying to circulate disease in the agricultural sector. It didn't work. And so now they have to embark on a new policy. And so I think we have to contemplate and ask how and why you had these different results of these two major developments, perhaps the major developments in the Americas over the past two centuries, that is to say the Haitian Revolution on the one hand and the Cuban Revolution on the other.
Well, let's talk about the president himself. And this being a signature move on his part, is this an act of recklessness or is this an act of dogged determination to carve a legacy for himself before he goes?
Well, it's very interesting. As you know, since that humbling loss on the first Tuesday in November 2014, President Obama has moved aggressively on immigration, moved aggressively on climate change, and now moved aggressively on Cuba. I expect some sort of deal with Iran sooner rather than later. There's a possibility, an underlying possibility, that the United States may not veto resolutions in the United Nations that seek to penalize Israel because of its policies of aggression and colonialism in the West Bank and Gaza. And so to a certain degree, you see Obama unbound, Obama liberated to a degree, although, as you know, the white right has different ideas for this president. They plan to give him a comeuppance sooner rather than later. But I assume that Mr. Obama and his advisors have come finally to the conclusion that, as now majority leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky said when he first came into office, his priority number one was to undermine and destabilize his administration. And therefore, given that recalcitrance by the Republicans, that reaching out to them was bound to lead to negative results at best. And so since they're going to oppose him anyway, he may as well be more aggressive in terms of implementing his policies on immigration, climate change, Cuba, perhaps Iran, perhaps Israel, etc. And that certainly helps to create a legacy, although it's going to be interesting to see if this also creates problems for his opposition. As you know, we've already made reference to how the Cuba policy is going to create difficulties for the opposition because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as noted, is in favor of this normalizing. You know, with regard to immigration, the Country Club Republicans are in favor of immigration reform, but it's the white, right, working class, middle class base that's adamantly opposed to this immigration reform, which is obviously going to trip up former governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, when he throws his hat into the ring formally. So at once, Mr. Obama is creating problems for himself by these policies, but he's also creating problems for his opposition.
That's true, because even when the Marco Rubios and Ileana Ros-Lehtinen and Menendez of New Jersey, they have a very, very narrow view, but I suspect that this would cause some problems within the Latino community itself, because now we will have the countervailing force that the Cubans have dominated the politics for so long, but we see now the rise of Mexicans, the rise of Puerto Ricans who are moving back to the United States in record numbers, coming back stateside. So we are seeing a dynamic forming where even if the Cuban leadership and a significant portion of the exile community does oppose, there will be a countervailing force. But again, they do feel let down by the Democratic Party.
Well, and it's well known that in the Cuban-American community, there's already a rift between younger Cuban-Americans who have vague, at best, memories of 1959. Many of them, like Mr. Obama himself, were not even born in 1959. It's interesting that in the pictures that were broadcast widely of the demonstrations in Little Havana yesterday, that most of those holding the signs of opposition were graybeards. Senior citizens, not that many youth. And as is well known, the Democrats have not necessarily done badly on the presidential election in Florida, even when Mr. Obama announced that he had changes in store for Cuban policy. I think it's interesting to note as well that this may also cause some issues in the black community. You mentioned my book, Race to Revolution, in the final pages. I note that in 2009, a number of leading black intellectuals, including Maya Angelou, the late Maya Angelou, and others who are still with us, stridently castigated Cuba's policy with regard to what they saw as racism, with regard to what they saw as a maltreatment of Cubans of African descent. Now, of course, the Cuban supporters, including regime supporters in Havana, pointed out what I mentioned a few moments ago, which is that after the special period and the escalation of remittances, that this meant that so-called Euro-Cubans could send more money to the island, which helps to contribute to this yawning racial gap. And then, of course, other supporters pointed out to Cuba's policies in Africa, that is to say, helping to liberate Southern Africa fundamentally, which helps to explain why in December 2013, at Nelson Mandela's funeral and all the heads of state showing in and jetting in, that Cuban President Raul Castro was one of the few asked to make an address. President Obama himself made reference to the Cuban medics and epidemiologists and physicians who were fighting Ebola in West Africa, and President Obama, to his credit, hoped and said he would seek to ensure that U.S. Medics would work alongside Cuban medics in helping to arrest this spreading pandemic. So it's going to be interesting to see what kinds of difficulties are created in the black community as a result of this new normalized policy. I'm not sure. I don't know what you think.
Well, it's a wait and see, because there are so many factors here that have not yet been fleshed out. So I think that's where we could leave it for the moment, that we're waiting and we'll see. So thanks so much. I want to thank you always, Gerald, for your penetrating views on these things and your analysis, which is uncommonly, just absolutely brilliant, just absolutely brilliant. I want to thank you so much for making yourself available to us today. What I'm going to do after we say goodbye is I'm going to play the speech so that people get a sense of, from the president's own mouth, what he says is the rationale behind his decision. But thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Well, let's listen to what President Obama said. This was a historic moment by any measure, and it is important to kind of get a sense in a historic moment what the main player, the main actor in this drama is outlining as the basis for his action. Here's President Obama explaining yesterday what the rationale is behind his decision to seek rapprochement with Cuba.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba. In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas. There's a complicated history between the United States and Cuba. I was born in 1961, just over 2 years after Fidel Castro took power in Cuba, and just a few months after the Bay of Pigs invasion, which tried to overthrow his regime. Over the next several decades, the relationship between our countries played out against the backdrop of the Cold War and America's steadfast opposition to communism. We're separated by just over 90 miles, but year after year, an ideological and economic barrier hardened between our two countries. Meanwhile, the Cuban exile community in the United States made enormous contributions to our country in politics and business, culture and sports. Like immigrants before, Cubans helped remake America, even as they felt a painful yearning for the land and families they left behind. All of this bound America and Cuba in a unique relationship, at once family and foe. Proudly, the United States has supported democracy and human rights in Cuba through these five decades. We've done so primarily through policies that aim to isolate the island, preventing the most basic travel and commerce that Americans can enjoy anyplace else. And though this policy has been rooted in the best of intentions, no other nation joins us in imposing these sanctions, and it has had little effect beyond providing the Cuban government with a rationale for restrictions on its people. Today, Cuba is still governed by the Castros and the Communist Party that came to power half a century ago. Neither the American nor Cuban people are well served by a rigid policy that's rooted in events that took place before most of us were born. Consider that for more than 35 years, we've had relations with China, a far larger country also governed by a Communist Party. Nearly two decades ago, we reestablished relations with Vietnam, where we fought a war that claimed more Americans than any Cold War confrontation. That's why, when I came into office, I promised to re-examine our Cuba policy. As a start, we lifted restrictions for Cuban Americans to travel and send remittances to their families in Cuba. These changes, once controversial, now seem obvious. Cuban Americans have been reunited with their families and are the best possible ambassadors for our values. And through these exchanges, a younger generation of Cuban Americans has increasingly questioned an approach that does more to keep Cuba closed off from an interconnected world. While I've been prepared to take additional steps for some time, a major obstacle stood in our way: the wrongful imprisonment in Cuba of a U.S. citizen and USAID subcontractor, Alan Gross, for 5 years. Over many months, my administration has held discussions with the Cuban government about Alan's case and other aspects of our relationship. His Holiness Pope Francis issued a personal appeal to me and to Cuba's President Raul Castro, urging us to resolve Alan's case and to address Cuba's interest in the release of three Cuban agents who've been jailed in the United States for over 15 years. Today, Alan returned home, reunited with his family at long last. Alan was released by the Cuban government on humanitarian grounds. Separately, in exchange for the three Cuban agents, Cuba today released one of the most important intelligence agents that the United States has ever had in Cuba, and who has been imprisoned for nearly two decades. This man, whose sacrifice has been known to only a few, provided America with the information that allowed us to arrest the network of Cuban agents that included the men transferred to Cuba today, as well as other spies in the United States. This man is now safely on our shores. Having recovered these two men who sacrificed for our country, I'm now taking steps to place the interests of the people of both countries at the heart of our policy. First, I've instructed Secretary Kerry to immediately begin discussions with Cuba to reestablish diplomatic relations that have been severed since January of 1961. Going forward, the United States will reestablish an embassy in Havana, and high-ranking officials will visit Cuba. Where we can advance shared interests, we will, on issues like health, migration, counterterrorism, drug trafficking, and disaster response. Indeed, we've seen the benefits of cooperation between our countries before. It was a Cuban, Carlos Finlay, who discovered that mosquitoes carry yellow fever. His work helped Walter Reed fight it. Cuba has sent hundreds of healthcare workers to Africa to fight Ebola, and I believe American and Cuban healthcare workers should work side by side to stop the spread of this deadly disease. Now, where we disagree, we will raise those differences directly, as we will continue to do on issues related to democracy and human rights in Cuba. But I believe that we can do more to support the Cuban people and promote our values through engagement. After all, these 50 years have shown that isolation has not worked. It's time for a new approach. Second, I've instructed Secretary Kerry to review Cuba's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism. This review will be guided by the facts and the law. Terrorism has changed in the last several decades. At a time when we are focused on threats from Al-Qaeda to ISIL, a nation that meets our conditions and renounces the use of terrorism should not face this sanction. Third, we are taking steps to increase travel, commerce, and the flow of information to and from Cuba. This is fundamentally about freedom and openness, and also expresses my belief in the power of people-to-people engagement. With the changes I'm announcing today, it will be easier for Americans to travel to Cuba, and Americans will be able to use American credit and debit cards on the island. Nobody represents America's values better than the American people, and I believe this contact will ultimately do more to empower the Cuban people. I also believe that more resources should be able to reach the Cuban people. So we're significantly increasing the amount of money that can be sent to Cuba and removing limits on remittances that support humanitarian projects, the Cuban people, and the emerging Cuban private sector. I believe that American businesses should not be put at a disadvantage, and that increased commerce is good for Americans and for Cubans. So we will facilitate authorized transactions between the United States and Cuba. U.S. financial institutions will be allowed to open accounts at Cuban financial institutions, and it will be easier for U.S. exporters to sell goods in Cuba. I believe in the free flow of information. Unfortunately, our sanctions on Cuba have denied Cubans access to technology that has empowered individuals around the globe. So I've authorized increased telecommunications connections between the United States and Cuba. Businesses will be able to sell goods that enable Cubans to communicate with the United States and other countries. These are the steps that I can take as president to change this policy. The embargo that's been imposed for decades is now codified in legislation. As these changes unfold, I look forward to engaging Congress in an honest and serious debate about lifting the embargo. Yesterday, I spoke with Raul Castro to finalize Alan Gross's release and the exchange of prisoners, and to describe how we will move forward. I made clear my strong belief that Cuban society is constrained by restrictions on its citizens. In addition to the return of Alan Gross and the release of our intelligence agent, we welcome Cuba's decision to release a substantial number of prisoners whose cases were directly raised with the Cuban government by my team. We welcome Cuba's decision to provide more access to the Internet for its citizens and to continue increasing engagement with international institutions like the United Nations and the International Committee of the Red Cross that promote universal values. But I'm under no illusion about the continued barriers to freedom that remain for ordinary Cubans. The United States believes that no Cuban should face harassment or arrest or beatings simply because they're exercising a universal right to have their voices heard. And we will continue to support civil society there. While Cuba has made reforms to gradually open up its economy, we continue to believe that Cuban workers should be free to form unions, just as their citizens should be free to participate in the political process. Moreover, given Cuba's history, I expect it will continue to pursue foreign policies that will at times be sharply at odds with American interests. I do not expect the changes I'm announcing today to bring about a transformation of Cuban society overnight, but I am convinced that through a policy of engagement, we can more effectively stand up for our values and help the Cuban people help themselves as they move into the 21st century. To those who oppose the steps I'm announcing today, let me say that I respect your passion and share your commitment to liberty and democracy. The question is how we uphold that commitment. I do not believe we can keep doing the same thing for over five decades and expect a different result. Moreover, it does not serve America's interests or the Cuban people to try to push Cuba towards collapse. Even if that worked, and it hasn't for 50 years, we know from hard-earned experience that countries are more likely to enjoy lasting transformation if their people are not subjected to chaos.
You're listening to PRN.FM. Lead Stories is the program. I'm Eutrice Lead. 2 days ago, we discussed the Reverend Edward Pinckney, convicted in a Berrien County court of altering petitions. He was heading up a recall of the local mayor who seemed to be in the pocket of Whirlpool Corporation, which has an intention to just clear Benton Harbor, an almost all black town on the lake shore of Michigan, and decided that he would lead this effort. And it led to a trial by an all white jury, white judge, white prosecutor, and he was sentenced to 2.5 years to 10 years in prison. I want to share with you the clarity of a person who witnessed that trial. Her name is Marion Kramer, and she had been active and has been active with the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization. A fellow activist who sent me this clip, Leona McElveen, had sent me this clip, and I thought it was such a poignant explanation of a consciousness and an explanation of why it is that injustice is all our concern and the fight for justice is all our business. I just thought this was the best definition I had heard in a long time of what we should regard as genuine, organically grown leadership. This is the leadership that we should support. This is the leadership that we should embrace. But listen, if you will, it struck me, very simply put, very sincere, very direct, and so clear about what the stark choices are. So please, listen to Marion Kramer as she describes her observation of this trial, but more so talks about the role that we all have in creating a just society.
Hi, Marion. Could you talk a little bit about your experience today being in St. Joseph, Michigan, in Benton Harbor for the sentencing of Reverend Edward Pinckney?
It was a setback in history. It was very hurting because everything that we have talked about came to a point today when here's an innocent man standing in court being accused of a crime that they never had any evidence of, and sending Reverend Pinckney to prison, sentencing them to prison for 3 to 10 years for a recall petition claiming that he had changed the date on the recall petition. Now, since when? I don't know. There's no law in the book saying that that's a felony. But yet and still, this judge felt that he can do what in the hell he wants when he wants to. And he has the backing of such corporations as Whirlpool. That's why they were sentencing Reverend Pinckney today. It's because Reverend Pinckney has stood up against the injustice of this corporation in Benton Harbor, and have exposed the players that represent the interests of Whirlpool. So on the one hand, they played it out saying it was for the recall petition, but on the other hand, we know that they wanted to get Reverend Pinckney off the streets and in a confined place that they figured would shut him up. So, you know, that was my experience today. But all this in a place with this governor in this state and this old court and this old tool that they have been using as far as the emergency manager. Not only did Reverend Pinckney has played a role to inform and fight for against the injustice in Benton Harbor and throughout the country, but Reverend Pinckney has been one of the figures that was in the forefront of fighting in Benton Harbor for the beach site to not to be taken away from the people of Benton Harbor that was willed to them years ago. And when they was told in this will that they should never sell it or give it away, it because it was there for the interest of the people in Benton Harbor. It was rezoned under the past governors and what have you for Whirlpool and the rest of them to be able to have a golf course. So it was taken, stolen, just like they put Native Americans on reservations. It's the same thing that they have done every time in this capitalist country. They go through a rezoning of an area, not for our benefits, but you check the rezoning committees and stuff like that. It's always a rezoning for the benefit of corporations and to move us out. And Reverend Pinckney was a thorn in their side around them, mobilizing and educating people not only in Benton Harbor, but people throughout the country as to what is happening. Because on the one hand, it was the exposure that he was putting out there that we found out they wanted to turn this into a playground for the rich and build condos along the lakefront and connect up with Chicago. So, you know, Reverend Pinckney, they can lie all they want. It was not about the petition. It was about the fact that Reverend Pinckney has been exposing the interconnection between them and who's really running the government up there is Whirlpool. And that's what this situation was about today. I mean, here you have a judge sitting up there and defending a jury that didn't even know their heads from a hole in the ground. And never did, was given the right instructions in the first place. It was not a jury, as they say, of his peer. None of them have ever lived in Benton Harbor. None of them have even knew what was going on. But yet and still, they were just like a lot of the people in Benton Harbor, under duress and afraid, if I don't go this way, then therefore no telling what could happen to me. But, some of that fear was there. But at the other hand, they were kept in the dark as to what this trial was really all about. And they, through their own ignorance, voted to send Reverend Pinckney, said he was guilty. Guilty of what? I'm trying to figure out right now. Guilty of what? Being a black man in America, a part of the working class, be you disabled or whatever, and trying to fight for our future. That's what he was guilty about. And that's what, and the other thing we have to understand is that in a place here, it's the fact that at one time, Whirlpool was the biggest, and still is, the biggest employer in Benton Harbor. And they don't need all the people to work no more because, almost 90% of the people that live in Benton Harbor are unemployed. Well, when we looked across the bay there in St. Joseph, most of the people are employed. So, they don't need all those people in Benton Harbor no more. So people like Reverend Pinckney is a thorn in their side because he's been able to expose the interconnection of the people that are running the government there, along with the connection of Whirlpool and the fact that they have a plan for Benton Harbor. They have a plan for St. Joseph, and that plan do not include the people in Benton Harbor. So that's what the situation was all about today. They think they're going to keep Reverend Pinckney mouth and organizing ability is going to cease because they're going to put him in prison. No, not Reverend Pinckney. We have confidence in him, and I have confidence in the people that were there because they were outraged. If they don't know, if they don't haven't seen fascism and knew what fascism was about in the past, they saw a taste of it today. That they can convict us, send us to jail, hang us, or anything else without having any evidence. And they teach you this bill of goods when you soon you hit the school about justice. And we have to always understand and did not understand the correctness of justice when the capitalists look at it. It's J-U-S-T hyphen just us and not me. But just us mean that it's for the rich at our expense, and that prevailed today. It prevailed today. Now, I think one of the key things we have to understand is although he was sentenced, and Reverend Pinckney is not a rich man, he is being charged a fee for being sentenced. He's not only going to have to pay all these fees for the court costs, for the attorney costs, and all that type of stuff. He's responsible for that, too. But he's going to have to pay to even to be in prison. I mean, come on. Don't they squeeze us enough as it is? So, we have to really understand what this was all about today. If we allow this type of thing to continually go on, they're coming after us. So we have to mount a campaign to free Reverend Pinckney, and that we all Reverend Pinckney. And it's just like what is happening around the country on the outright war on young black males and as other young males around the country. But what is happening, we all must come on, and a lot of folks going to run away from it. Some of those people need to run away. because they'll try to stop what we got to do. But today was very significant. Today was a historical event. Mm-hmm. And it was so wonderful to be among the masses to see that they were angry, that they had finally learned that there was no justice in this country for us unless we organize to take what needs to be taken out here for the benefit of us, for the benefit of our children and the future. Because these people are not playing. They don't need us to work. You don't need to have a life. And they showed that today. Mm-hmm. And Reverend Pinckney showed us another thing, that we need to fight. We need to fight to change the system and have a system, a decent system that is for the benefit of us all. In other words, we don't have to face homelessness. We don't have to face the possibility that we don't have no health care. Our children don't have an education. The fact that you can grow on old and be able to live out here and that type of thing. We want to be able to live and not barely survive. That's what Reverend Pinckney is about. And that's the type of justice he has constantly fought for. So we need you. We need you to join in with us, bring your expertise, join the fight, and become one of these generals out here to be able to help make sure that we do have a future. And I sit here in front, I thought this was an excellent idea that you stopped us and stopped in our home and put General in the background because he loved Reverend Pinckney and Dorothy. And, you know, I know if he was here in the flush today, he'd be right here with us. And he would be running his mouth. And he would say, when one fall down, another one has to step up. Many has to step up. We have to step up now and make sure we not only make Reverend Pinckney's goal a reality, which is our goal, because we are all Reverend Pinckney's, but we have to fight for a better society, a better system. Capitalism is killing us. What are you going to do? That's the question. We need you. We need your expertise. You are the leaders that we have been waiting for. So step on out and let's get Reverend Pinckney freed and let's go on about our business and making sure we're going to create a society for the benefit of us all. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. That was a history lesson and a civics lesson all at the same time. Thank you very much, Marion Kramer, for that. And thank you very much, Leona McElveen, for recording that. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope you found value in it. Please do stay tuned. Coming up next is Occupied Territory America with Mike Fader. Drop me a note at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.